On top of that, I forgot to tell a joke last lecture, and so I have to fit two jokes into this lecture. So anyway, it's going to be, you know, we're gonna just going to have to be disciplined. And, you know, it's like athletes training for the Olympics or something like that. We really need to step up our game if we want to be champions. That was, okay. So that's on video, me saying that. Anyway, it's kind of embarrassing. But, okay. So, so we were going through basically, you know, so the idea of the rest of the course is to focus as much as possible on, you know, what are the things that are not understood, and then what are the sort of there are a bunch of basic mysteries in cosmology that remain. One of the most important ones is what is dark matter, and we just want to have a brief taste of what are the sort of menu of the leading options for explaining these things. Roughly speaking, how would you calculate them? Or check that a formerly leading menu option has been removed from the menu. And so we had already done that for. We'd already explained in brief how machos are are disfavored by microlensing experiments and considerations of Hawking radiation. And then among WIMPs, we had explained how a simple calculation about hot thermal relics had first of all given us a rather stringent bound on the mass, upper bound on the sum of the masses of the neutrinos, but it also had also shown that any hot thermal relic, dark matter candidate, had to be quite low in mass, and that as a result, that dark matter candidate is basically ruled out because, so when it decoupled, it was still relativistic. Suddenly it had a chance to free stream across the universe until the Hubble drag had finally brought it to rest. It manages to free stream across the universe enough that it smooths out small scale structures. If there were at very early times peaks in the density field at one point in space and valleys at a neighboring point in space, then if the dark matter particles that make up these peaks and valleys are randomly allowed to free stream, essentially like photons, in any direction, the effect is to smooth out these peaks, that the matter falls into the valleys and everything evens out. And the only density perturbations that remain are density perturbations that are longer in wavelength than the distance by which these particles have had a chance to free stream. And in short, without going in detail through the calculation or showing you the observations, the bottom line is that we observe too much small scale structure. We do observe these long wavelength fluctuations, but we also observe structures in the universe today that grew from smaller wavelength fluctuations that are correlated on smaller scales. And so that's the basic reason that these guys are no longer allowed. So cold thermal relics, these again are where I would currently put my money. And so I just wanted to briefly say why that is. So, okay. So what we want to do, the basic thing that I want to show you is that, so let's say there's some relic that initially wasn't, there's some particle, massive particle with mass m sub chi and interaction rate gamma sub chi that stays in equilibrium until its mass is low relative to the temperature. So that's what we mean by a cold thermal relic. So now basically we just want to calculate what was its abundance at freeze out, and then by requiring that its abundance at freeze out over the rest of the relativistic entropy density at freeze out, was equal to its abundance, the ratio of its abundance today, to the relativistic entropy density today. We know these three numbers. We can calculate this guy. And then from there, we will calculate its energy density today. And the point is to observe that in this calculation, first of all, the mass drops out. It only at the end of this calculation, when we compare the energy density of the chi particle today to the critical density today, and again, this is the number that if it's going to be the dark matter particle, we want to be about 0.25. M chi only appears logarithmically in this relationship. It drops out. There's an m chi here, and then a 1 over m chi in this expression that cancel. And so the only dependence on m chi, so the dependence on m on the mass of the chi particle is very weak, which is to say this argument isn't going to tell us much about the mass of the chi particle. But the dependence on the cross section, on the interaction cross section, for this reaction where two chi particles annihilate to something or other, let's say two photons or who knows what. This cross section turns out to be exactly or roughly what you would expect for a weak interaction. If these were weakly interacting particles. So for example, if this annihilation, you know, chi goes to some weak gauge boson, the W boson or something like that, and then to two electrons or something like that. Or maybe the Higgs particle. This cross section is about the size that you would estimate for that. So in other words, you have a bunch of astronomical numbers that cancel to give roughly a number that is kind of very appealing from a particle physics standpoint. So as I say, we don't know much in dark matter, but this is the most positive hint that we have, I would say, from cosmology about what it is. So in a bit more detail. And again, I'm just going to sketch the calculation briefly, so that the rest of it is, as you know, on the homework. So we want to calculate the freeze out occurs when the annihilation rate, when this reaction, two chi's going to particles that are in the thermal bath, this reaction that keeps the chi's in contact with the thermal bath and lets them annihilate when thermal equilibrium wants to drive down their number density. We want to know at freeze out, which I'll use the sub F to denote, that's about equal to the Hubble rate at freeze out. You may at some point begin getting used to this sort of calculation so much so that it begins to look boring to see someone else do it. And if that happens, that's great. That means that you're probably ready to go off and do these things on your own easily. But this is in case we're not quite there yet. So gamma sub f. Well, if I have a little chi particle and it's moving at speed v. And its cross section for running into another chi particle is sigma, then I can think of that chi particle as carrying along a little target of area sigma here, and it's moving at speed v, so that in a time t, it moves a distance vt, and so the volume that it sweeps out is sigma vt. And on average, the amount of time that it has to travel before it runs into another chi particle is just equal to, that's given by the moment at which this volume contains, on average, one chi particle. You know, because the question is, has this little target, this cross section sigma, had a chance to run into another chi particle? So. So in other words, when this volume times the number density of chi particles is equal to 1. So dividing by t, this says that the that 1 over the average time, or in other words, the 1 over the average time it takes for a chi particle to run into another one, or in other words, the chi annihilation rate is equal to the cross section characterizing that reaction, the typical velocity that the chi particles are moving at, times the number density of chi particles. Okay, and so really we're imagining that they can have a distribution of velocities. The cross section may be a function of velocity, and furthermore, the cross section may depend on the relative spin states of the two chi particles that are running into each other, and we're imagining that those are arbitrarily distributed. And so, you know, really to do this properly, this should be some overall average over velocities and spin states of the chi particles times this is that's the interaction rate. But we're just doing back of the envelope calculations, so this is not a terribly big deal. Now, to expand this out a little bit more, I'll estimate that sigma v is at the moment of freeze out is sigma at the moment of freeze out times v at the moment of freeze out. But so the particle, at least up until the moment of freeze out, was in thermal equilibrium, and so the velocity of a particle in thermal equilibrium, you know, it has kinetic energy. You know, the temperature is for a massive particle roughly sets its kinetic energy, and so the velocity of this chi particle it frees out is something like t frees out, square root of t frees out over m of the chi particle. And then, by assumption at freeze out, we're talking about a cold thermal relic. So by assumption, the particle is non-relativistic. So we use the non-relativistic formula for the chi's here. So that's this thing you derived also on the problem set. Where you'll notice that again by assumption I'm taking the chi particle to have no chemical potential. I've said its chemical potential equal to zero, and that's basically for the same reason that the photon's chemical potential is equal to zero. That we're saying that chi and chi two chi's can annihilate into things that have essentially negligible chemical potential, such as photons or, at this early epoch, electrons. So in chemical equilibrium, the chi's chemical potentials are also negligible. Okay, so this thing, that's my expression for gamma, and then I want to set that equal to my expression for H. And again, the way we always get our expression for H is we use the Friedmann equation. Is 8 pi g over 3 rho, and then g newton. It's convenient to rewrite that as 1 over m Planck squared. And then rho, we use our expression for in a thermal bath. That's equal to the number of particles, number of relativistic particles times their temperature to the fourth, and then times this factor, which you may regret that you're beginning to remember. So the square root of this expression, okay, 8 pi over 3 m Planck, times this business. So now if you look at that, then this is also evaluated at t freeze out. So 8 pi over 3 m Planck squared times rho frees out here. So now if you look at that expression, apart from factors of, you know, factors of 10 or 100, this G star and maybe G chi is 2 or something, and you don't know what sigma f is, but the rest of this expression can be solved for, let's define x frees out to be m chi over t frees out. So x frees out is a dimensionless number expressing how non-relativistic the particle is. So if tf is very low relative to m chi, that means that this dimensionless number is much greater than 1. Right? OK, so we can solve this equation now for x sub f. And so that's the first thing that you get some expression in your, you'll get some expression by just solving that equation in your homework. And the expression is simply log of, okay, some numbers, and then m Planck times m chi times this constant, the annihilation cross-section, it frees out. And so this is dimensionless, notice, because this is units of mass, and units of length squared, which in if we said h bar is equal to c is equal to 1, that's units of 1 over mass squared. And so these numerical factors that I've included, those are not to be taken seriously. You know, there's like a 3 root 10 over 2 pi cubed in equation 3. So, you know, for example, when we set gamma equals to h at freeze out, that's quite a rough relation. So, I mean, really we should not be worrying too much about order 1 factors. But just as I only introduced the entropy density. Yeah, the difference between calculating the freeze out abundance of this chi particle and like you were saying, the photon number density, following that as a function of time as opposed to following the ratio of that to the total entropy density, that all boils down to an roughly order unity factors, which you really shouldn't worry about too much. I've only been using S so that when you compare to other books, it'll be easier to check that your work agrees with what other people are doing. And similarly here, I've only included these factors like 3 root 10 so that when you're going through the algebra, you can check whether you're really doing the same algebra that I had in mind. But the actual factors, you should not put too much stock in. Unless they appear inside an exponent, and then they're important. Any numerical factors that appear inside an exponent, generally speaking, if you don't know how to calculate them properly, you're probably not calculating the right. You're probably not getting even the order of magnitude for that answer correctly. But as long as the order 1 factors are outside the exponent or in a log, like they are here, then you know, as far as just getting a sense of whether some technique might work or might not work, this is, yeah, as at Gamov level, this is good. Yeah.
Drive that in the homework, but yeah. That was starting from like bosons or fermions. So how do we know that these particles obey?
Oh, whether it's a boson or fermion,
yeah, or
something else.
Yeah.
Well, so in 3+1 dimensions, everything is a boson or fermion. This is a general result from quantum field theory. So which I so in 2+1 dimensions, you can have other things. But so let's take it for granted that it's a boson or a fermion. Now you're right that I haven't written, like you say, this formula should have an extra. Sorry. Also in the non-relativistic formula, I think that factor of 7/8 doesn't appear actually. But in any case, the basic argument applies whether this thing is a boson or a fermionic particle. In practice, it doesn't. Yeah. So various things that get considered for this particle include not just there are theories not just where this particle is a scalar spin zero particle or a spin 1/2 particle, but there's also, for example, the gravitino. This particle may be the gravitino. It could be. It still remains possible that the standard model has a complement of superpartners, and a graviton has a superpartner called the gravitino, which has spin 3 halves. And that is actually still a viable candidate for what this cold thermal relic might be. I should also say I won't explain here why there are only bosons or fermions. There's two results. One is that in 3+1 dimensions, when you exchange two identical particles, the wave function either picks up a plus sign or a minus sign. Those are the only two options. And then a related point is that the particles with integer multiple of h bar as their spin have to be the ones that pick up a plus sign, and the particles that have a half integer multiple, like 1/2 h bar, like a electron, have to pick up the minus sign. So that I don't mean to make that sound. So that actually is. I'm not going to derive that here, but there's a nice geometrical argument for why that is, that you can read about, for example, in it's explained in one of the opening chapters of volume 1 of Weinberg's field theory book, which some people hate, but I really like. I mean, so different anyway. That's yeah. Sorry. I have a way of. The questions that I'm not going to answer, I still spend a long time not answering them. I don't know, that's another, it's like along with linearity of board usage is another clearly thing to work on for next. So now that we have this quantity XF, we can plug that into our expression here for the number density it frees out, because we can rewrite this TF as, you know, you understand. We can use that expression for XF to eliminate TF everywhere it appears in this expression, and we end up with an expression for N sub chi at freeze out. We divide that by the expression for S at freeze out, which is this thing we discussed last time. G at freeze out. Oh, I should say. Also, just something that, again, I only mention not because it's really important to getting the right numerical result, but because I worry that it could confuse you on your homework. So I use G at freeze out and GS at freeze out interchangeably. So G at freeze out is the G. Sorry, that should be GF. G sub F is the sort of overall factor that comes from the fact that there are multiple species, multiple relativistic species contributing to the overall energy density. And G sub S at freeze out is the same thing, but in the expression for multiple species contributing to the overall entropy density. And it is believed, in any case, I assume in the notes, so when you're checking my calculation, that these two things are equal prior to when everything is in thermal equilibrium, these two guys are equal. So if everything is in thermal equilibrium at the same temperature, these two guys are equal. The only reason cosmology books trouble you with this distinction is that there is this moment around Big Bang nucleosynthesis that we described where neutrinos freeze out and then electrons and protons annihilate. Electrons and positrons annihilate with one another, and that turns out to, right after that happens, and for the rest of the universe, neutrinos, as we discussed, have a slightly different temperature than photons do. And because of that, these two things turn out to be different in the late universe, but these are all order one factors as far as we're concerned for this estimate. So we set this equal to n chi today. I think maybe I've sketched enough of the calculation. I think the main thing that I wanted to explain was So the rest is algebra. You T0, that's the photon temperature today. That's a known quantity that I give in the lecture notes. GS, that's another known quantity that I'm not going to go into how it's derived, but it's about 4. So you now have enough information to get an expression for n chi of 0, and as I said before, since the particle is relativistic, you can just multiply by the mass to get the energy density. And then you divide by the expression for the critical density, and the rest is just checking that the resulting expression that you have has the properties that I said, that m sub chi drops out except from the logarithm, and that sigma appears in the logarithm, but also outside as a prefactor. And so essentially, the logarithmic factor has such a weak dependence in the answer that to a first approximation, so you'll see by playing around with this formula that it has this, that it has that, that that the resulting expression is equal to what you want when this has a typical weak cross section. And so let's just say briefly what we mean by a typical weak cross section. What do I expect if for the cross section for this to be? Like let's say chi and chi annihilate to 2 photons, and they do so via the weak interactions, by which I mean to say that the particle here has a mass typical of the part of the massive weak particle. So the W boson, the Z boson, the Higgs boson, they all have masses of roughly 100 GeV, in the hundreds of GeV, we think. Well, these guys we know, this guy we think. And so if one of those weakly interacting particles carries the annihilation and to 2 photons or 2 electrons, say, or an electron and a neutrino, or what, depending on what the carrier is, the bottom line is that, so we have a coupling constant here, a weak coupling constant here, so we have G squared. We have a propagator here, which gives you a 1 over this mass scale squared. So that's all what we had called the Fermi constant before. That was so we'd explained that this sort of calculation explains why in weak interactions you end up getting this Fermi constant that is typically 1/10 divided by 100 GeV squared. So something like 1 over 10 to the fifth GeV squared. And then, so that's what we estimate based on almost no knowledge, just based on the idea that it's a weak interaction for the diagram. And then when we're calculating the cross section, this is the amplitude, the thing that we calculated for the Feynman diagram. To calculate a cross section, you always start by squaring the amplitude. But so far, the amplitude squared, that's GF squared, has units of 1 over mass to the fourth, whereas dimensionally we want it to have mass of m squared, 1 over m squared. So we have to multiply by two factors of mass, and if this particle is massive and is annihilating to things that are of much lower mass, like if it can annihilate to photons or something, then for phase space reasons that will dominate. Since there's the most phase space, since there's, you know, if you have a particle and all other things being equal, it can annihilate to a particle of higher mass or a particle of lower mass. When it annihilates to a particle of lower mass, those lower mass particles can have a bigger range of possible final momenta. And so when you're integrating over that phase space of final momenta, when calculating this cross section, you get a bigger number the lower the mass is here. So if it can annihilate to particles that have very low masses relative to it, then the allowed phase space is basically the typical size of the momentum characterizing that range of phase space that the annihilation can go to is just the mass of the particle that's annihilating. These particles can have momenta that are as large as the mass of the particle that they're coming from. So we have something like m chi squared. And so the statement is just that, basically, roughly speaking, gf squared m chi squared. And you'll see that if you just plug in the Fermi constant here and take this to be, you know, the mass of a typical massive particle that you know and love, like the proton and the neutron, something like a GeV, that you get the right abundance of dark matter today. Okay, so that is the Wimp miracle that you see that's like our best bit of information about what dark matter is at a fundamental level, and it's so flimsy as you just saw from that argument. But anyway, it is what it is. That means there's a lot of good stuff to be discovered. Yeah.
The cross section depends on f squared, which is just from the dimensional analysis.
You mean this m?
No, the mass.
The mass. Yeah, that was dimensional analysis. I was saying under the way. So roughly speaking. Okay, and this will fail sometimes. But the rule of thumb that is often convenient, if you just want to get a back of the envelope estimate of some cross section or decay rate, is you write down the Feynman diagram that you think contributes, calculate m for that Feynman diagram, square it. Then you need to add mass. You need to add appropriate number of units of mass to get the cross section or the decay rate to have the right units. And when you're doing that, you just think about what are all the possible scales in the problem. There might be a temperature, there might be a mass, there might be a mass difference between the initial and final states. So you find all the relevant things that could appear in the final answer, and if one of them is much larger than the other one, than the other ones, you use that because probably you will generate terms of all those various, including all those various terms, multiplied together, but the biggest term will be the one where the biggest of the mass scales appears each time. So I'm saying, if this guy decays to some much smaller energy particle, then the biggest, at a temperature that is well below its mass, then the biggest mass scale available is the mass of that decaying particle, so I get that. So a man, after a joke, we will have a clearer idea of whether we should proceed with the final dark matter example or go straight to baryogenesis and leave the final dark matter example to the tutorial. Slava is walking along, and he encounters Petya playing chess with his dog. And he says, "Petya, you must have a very smart dog." Petya says, "Smart? I wish you were here a minute ago." Okay, sorry. "Smart? I wish you saw the move he made a minute ago." No. Okay. What can I say? I give and I give. You take and you take. What do you give back? Okay. Is anyone still copying this down, maybe? Okay. What especially hurts about that is that after I told it the first time, I was like, oh, it just didn't make sense. And then I told it more explicitly, and then you just didn't laugh. And then it was clear. Could not have been, no, it was unambiguous the second time. It just wasn't funny. Okay. So we have something like 20 minutes. Is that right? And
About 30 minutes.
I wanted to finish baryogenesis today to leave enough time to actually do inflation right. The final. Maybe I'll just give a very short sketch of the non-thermal relic, just so it's clear what should be going on. Just to make the tutorial go a little bit more smoothly, and then I'll quickly move on to baryogenesis. So, just as an example, as the simplest example of just a whole other approach to getting the right dark matter abundance, so something that has nothing to do with the particle ever being in thermal equilibrium in the early universe, there is just a, you can just have a simple scalar field, phi. And so this analysis will also be worthwhile because it's just going to introduce a few things that are then going to be immediately useful to us in understanding inflation. So suppose that there is some scalar field lurking in the early universe, you know, lurking in particle physics. Okay. For now, we can just, for simplicity, think of this as some completely decoupled thing from the rest of the standard model of particle physics. It's just on its own. So at the beginning of the class, for a single scalar field, we calculated T mu nu. So we had some general formula for how you get T mu nu given the matter Lagrangian. And then we said, okay, so given the scalar field Lagrangian with potential V, if you plug that into that formula, you get T mu nu is equal to something. Okay. That formula is in the first lecture notes. We got that formula when we were deriving Einstein's equations, and then we just plugged in the particular matter Lagrangian corresponding to a scalar field to find the particular stress energy corresponding to a single scalar field. So then, when we were deriving the Friedmann equations, we used this fact that T mu nu was a diagonal matrix that had its 0, 0 component was minus rho, and then and then along the diagonals the spatial components were pressure. So if you compare these two expressions, you'll find that rho is equal to 1/2. That for a homogeneous scalar field, let's forget about perturbations for a second. For this lecture, we'll get to them. So, but the scalar field only depends on time, doesn't depend on space. Then, if you compare these two expressions and use that restriction, you find that its energy density is given by a kinetic term plus a potential energy term, and its pressure is given by the same kinetic term minus a potential energy density. And then conservation of stress energy. So the stress energy tensor physically is just like in electromagnetism, if you have some charge Q, and there's a locally conserved current corresponding to it. So its charge density, there's some local, this is a globally conserved quantity, but there's some local charge density J mu of X, our current four vector J mu of X, whose first component is the charge density, and whose other three components are the spatial current density. Then someone probably made you once think about the fact that this equation, J mu, or let's see, in special relativity, you probably thought about it, comma mu is equal to 0, that expresses charge conservation locally. It's strong. This expression is stronger than saying just this global charge is conserved. And this expression makes sense even in general relativity. If you add a little colon, if you replace the partial derivative by a covariant derivative, even when the global charge may not be well defined or unambiguously defined. Because this says d rho d, it says partial rho, partial t, is equal to minus the divergence of j. And so this is just saying, physically, the right-hand side says, this is if you look at any little infinitesimal volume in a time dt, this tells you how much the total charge in that volume increases. And this says that whatever that increase is, it must be precisely equal to the amount of charge that minus the divergence of J, that's how much charge flowed in through the walls of that volume in that time T. So in any little arbitrarily chosen volume, the amount of the charge increases in a given time is precisely equal to the amount of charge that flowed in through the walls. So charge doesn't get created or destroyed out of nowhere. it only flows from one little volume into another, into the neighboring volumes. So T mu nu is the core. T mu nu is the analog. So if P mu, if the four momentum is the global charge analogous to Q, then just like this was a scalar, and so its current density was a one index object. This is a vector, so its corresponding density is a two index object, which is this. And so just as the local density corresponding to this conserved quantity had to satisfy this local conservation law, the local density corresponding to P mu, namely the stress energy tensor, has to also satisfy a conservation law, which is this guy. Now, in an FRW universe, an unperturbed FRW universe, you will find that, so this equation now has four components. The mu equals I components, the spatial components, are trivially zero in an FRW universe, but the mu equals zero component, that gives us this equation that so-called continuity equation that we had derived before in a different way, which is rho dot is equal to minus 3h rho plus p. So if you plug these expressions for rho and p into this equation, you get the equation of motion for the scalar field. It's phi double dot plus 3h phi dot plus v prime of phi is equal to 0. So now let's specialize for simplicity to the case that the particle is just a pure massive scalar field with no other interaction. So its potential is just 1/2 times its mass squared times phi squared. So in which case, this just becomes m squared phi. Okay. So now the following analysis is used again and again. Like, just as this business about calculating the freeze-out moment and then calculating the ratio of the freeze-out abundance of a particle to the entropy density, just as that sort of argument is ubiquitous in cosmology, another sort of argument that is ubiquitous and that it behooves you to become familiar with, you are behooved to be... I don't know whether... I always thought the word behoove was funny. Analyzing this sort of equation, when you're dealing both with the homogeneous evolution of the universe or with perturbations, happens again and again. So there are a few things to, you know, just the same story always applies, but in different variants. So this equation is like, you know, it should remind you of the equation for a damped harmonic oscillator. So if you have a particle with coordinate x, just moving in one dimension in a potential v of x, and Newton's law, in a potential v of x, which is equal to 1/2 m omega squared x squared, a quadratic potential, then Newton's law, m times the acceleration, is equal to minus v prime, so it's minus m omega squared x. So the Newton's law for this guy is x double dot plus omega squared x is equal to 0. And then if there's a friction term in here, that's like a term that's minus some constant times x dot. So there would be a plus constant times x dot here. Okay, so the equation for a damped harmonic oscillator, which you analyzed at some point in classical mechanics in college or in university. In the United States, college means the same thing as university. Do you guys know that? In Canada, apparently colleges and universities are like totally different things. I had to learn that the hard way. I mean, I had to learn that just by saying it to people and having them snicker at me, and I was like, okay. Anyway, in university, you will have studied an equation like this for the damped harmonic oscillator. So this equation looks like this, where 3H is playing the role of the friction term. So again, the expansion of the universe is acting like a drag, just like it did when particles were moving along geodesics across the universe. It was sucking energy out of them. So similarly, it's going to suck energy out of the motion of the scalar field in this equation. And then m squared is playing the role of the frequency of the harmonic oscillator. And so the main thing that you learned about this equation was that when gamma is sufficiently large, the There's three qualitatively different behaviors that it can have. When gamma is large relative to omega, gamma and omega have the same units, you see. They both have units of 1 over time here. So when gamma is large relative to omega, the oscillator is overdamped. When it's small, it's underdamped. And so in one case, you know, the friction dominates, and the force is just a little. If the friction dominates, then the particle just oozes down to the bottom of its potential, like as if it were as if there were, you know, wind resistance, and it's always moving at its terminal velocity. There's some force, and it's balancing the frictional force at all. It's moving just fast enough so that the force balances the frictional force, and it's always moving at its terminal velocity. Like if you jump off a building and reach your terminal velocity, don't jump. Yeah. So I'm always worried I'm gonna, you know, say things that will be misconstrued as encouraging you to do terrible things in the name of physics. But so on the other hand, when it's underdamped, you know, it oscillates back and forth in its potential, and the effect of the friction is just to slowly make the magnitude of this oscillation die away until it reaches zero. But the dominant thing is the forcing due to the potential. Okay, so in this case, H is not a constant. It's decreasing as a function of time as the universe expands. And so instead, the behavior makes a transition. At early times, when H is big relative to M, this scalar field is critically damped. It's basically pinned to its potential, slowly oozing down. Whereas at late times, when this term becomes negligible relative to this, eventually, when H drops enough, it becomes small relative to M, and then suddenly the field is released, and it becomes free to oscillate. And so that is the idea of these thermal relics. You have some scalar field, and early enough in the universe, it's basically pinned at some initial value phi I. It's basically a constant. The way you can see that it's a constant is that if this term can be ignored, then you can rearrange this equation to say phi double dot is equal to minus 3h, so over phi dot. So, but that integrates immediately to, since this is d phi dot over phi dot, and this is dA over A, this integrates to phi dot is proportional to a to the minus 3. So in other words, as the universe expands, as A increases, it sucks the kinetic, sucks whatever initial kinetic energy this field phi might have had out of it, and the field phi is just stuck at some point. Okay, and then you can calculate that there's some moment H at which M is equal to H, and the behavior changes over. So that's some moment hi. Again, you can calculate hi in terms of our this same argument that we used in the other dark matter cases. You say by the Friedmann equation, h squared is 8 pi over 3 m Planck squared times this expression, you know, g star t to the fourth. But then after that moment, in the opposite limit, the field will begin to oscillate with a decaying amplitude. And so the easiest way to quantitatively see how that oscillation will decay is to, a good trick is to switch variables to remove the friction term. So for example, in this case, if I make the substitution phi is equal to a to the minus 3/2 times u, and now I calculate phi dot, which would be equal to a to the minus 3/2 u dot minus 3/2 a to the minus 5/2 a dot u, and then I calculate phi double dot, and I plug those in. What I find is a new equation, which has a u double dot term, and then there's no u dot term. There's just a something times u. And the something times u is something plus m squared, and this something drops as 1 over t squared. It's some constant times 1 over t squared. So at late times, this term becomes negligible relative to the m squared. So it's just a harmonic oscillator with frequency m and no damping. So that has a simple solution. U is then just cosine omega t, or cosine mt. But then to get back to phi, we still have to multiply by a to the minus 3 here. So phi is equal to a to the minus 3 halves times cosine mt. So then if you plug this into the energy density, this expression for the energy density, you'll find that it's just dropping. As the field oscillates and decays, the energy density is dropping as a to the minus 3. just as if it was ordinary non-relativistic matter. Yeah. Go ahead.
If you just extend the concept of the force vacuum and the two vacuum.
Usually when people say false vacuum and true vacuum, they're talking about a different physical situation, which is where I've drawn a potential. You know, 1/2 m squared phi squared has just a single minimum, but you could have a scalar field that has a potential that looks like this, with two minima, where the field is, at least classically speaking, could be sitting stably in either of these minima. So that the equation of motion, phi double dot plus 3h, phi dot plus v prime of phi, the classical equation of motion for the homogeneous scalar field, has two solutions with phi equals constant here. If phi is a constant here, that works, because v prime, because then phi double dot vanishes, phi dot vanishes, and v prime vanishes at that point. But it's equally well a solution to put the field down here. Quantum mechanically, first of all, if you put the field here, it can tunnel to here, just like in quantum mechanics. If you put a particle in a potential, it looks like this. And you initially put the particle over here, it can eventually tunnel over to the lower vacuum. So same thing in cosmology. And also in cosmology, once you get into Einstein's equations, at the classical level, the equation of motion for the field phi doesn't depend on an overall constant change to v. But in general relativity, you do. If you change the potential by an overall constant, that's like changing the value of the cosmological constant. T mu nu does change, and so the Einstein equations change. And anyway, there's all sorts of interesting phenomena associated with tunneling or rolling from the false vacuum to the true vacuum.
Is this related to a kind of instant?
So yeah, the solution that you there's a yeah to calculate the rate of tunneling. It turns out that to leading order, what you find is a solution to the Euclidean equations of motion. You change t to it in the equations of motion for this field, and find a solution that looks like this at the origin and asymptotes to this field value out at infinity. And the solution that solves the Euclideanized equation of motion is called an instanton. And then yeah, so the rate of tunneling goes like e to the minus the action of that instanton. That's right. It is related. But unfortunately, originally I had this idea, you may remember at the beginning of the class, that I was going to get to this sort of thing, phase transitions, at the end of the class. But that unfortunately is not going to happen. So it's good that you brought it up, because that now, I'm sorry to say, is due to time constraint the only glimpse of a phase transition you're ever going to get in this course.
So
enjoy
question.
That.
Another question?
Oh yeah.
Where does the m squared phi term come from in that equation?
So I was saying that if you plug these expressions into the continuity equation, then when you're taking the derivative over here, the time derivative, mm-hmm. one of the terms that you will get will be like v prime of phi times phi dot, taking the time derivative of that v.
Yeah.
And so when you plug those expressions in here, you get this equation of motion, but with v prime of phi coming from that bit. And then I said we're specializing to the case that V prime, that V of phi is the simplest potential you can think of, just 1/2 m squared phi squared. And so, oh, V prime here, by the way. Yeah, sorry. So previously I had used a prime to denote a derivative with respect to conformal time. Is that what you?
No, but does the potential change with time or?
So the potential itself, no. So this is, so, and, sorry, so what I was going to say is previously we had used a dot to denote d dt and a prime to denote d d conformal time. But here by v prime of phi, I mean dv d phi. And so the potential itself, this function of phi is just constant with time, but the field value itself can change. So that's all there is to say. I'm kind of tempted to do. What do you say? It would be. I'm done. Is that right?
No, you have 10 more minutes.
Oh, I do? Oh, I started 20 minutes late?
10 more minutes.
Okay, great, great. Do you guys agree with that? Okay, so I am going to, because I'm really going to try to do just a very short baryogenesis bit. So in tutorial today, this is just a sketch of a. I was going to say one more thing. So the energy density of this field falls as a to the minus 3, but then its mass is m. So you can think of another way to think about it, if you want to convert it into the language of the previous problems, is you can divide this by m and define an effective number density for this field, which drops as a to the minus 3, just as if it was a conserved particle number. Now, in fact, this is not just an analogy. In fact, you have every right to interpret this oscillating field is a condensate of particles of mass m with this number density, but I'm not going to go into explaining that. But it's a very non-thermal condensate of particles. It's actually nearly or can even be a Bose-Einstein condensate of these particles. But in any case, so the point is you at the moment that it begins oscillating, you calculate its energy density. Convert that by dividing by m into its number density, and then from there you use that number density over s, the entropy, the relativistic entropy density, as a conserved quantity between then and today, and the rest of the argument is just the same as for the previous two cases that we dealt with. So quickly, baryogenesis. The universe today is full of baryons with no antibaryons. Apart from the antibaryons that are created in the LHC and the antibaryons that are created when high-energy cosmic rays strike the atmosphere, and those are absolutely piddling amounts of antibaryons, the universe is completely full of baryons. And it's a very sort of interesting story how one came to observationally discover that. But in short, we sent you don't annihilate with the Earth, so the Earth is made of baryons. We sent someone to the moon. They didn't annihilate with the moon. The moon is made of baryons. The rest of the solar system, in a similar way, was discovered to be made of baryons. More generally, basically, you can look out and say, if various parts, you know, you might, for example, for a long time, it was not clear that other galaxies were made of baryons. Like, why couldn't our galaxy be made of baryons and then another galaxy just be made of antibaryons? How would we know? And the answer is, if you try to play those games, you try to make various things out of antibaryons. The bottom line is that over the course of cosmological evolution, those antibaryons encounter baryons and annihilate with them. So galaxies, for example, we now know merge. A typical galaxy has merged multiple times during its history with another galaxy, and we never see giant bursts of annihilation radiation from those mergers. So in general, what we see is the radiation we see is almost t- to a very good approximation, cosmic microwave background radiation, if there was a substantial amount, if the universe was really a mixture of baryons and antibaryons, you would see vastly more gamma rays coming from their annihilation boundaries than you actually see. So roughly speaking, this is what we know. So the basic question is that I will sadly only get to treat very briefly, but you know, why and what does it tell us about fundamental physics? So the naive answer, the original answer, was that, well, up until the 70s, let's say, everyone thought that baryon number was a perfectly conserved quantity. And in fact, until today, we've never observed any baryon violating process. Every physical process that has ever been observed in any laboratory has the same total baryon number going in as baryon number coming out. Let me quickly say what baryon number is. So baryon number, I just mean, let's say quarks carry baryon number 1/3, antiquarks carry baryon number minus 1/3, and then all other particles, leptons, Higgs particle, any other particles that we're aware of, carry baryon number 0. And so, for example, what a particle physicist calls a baryon, which is made up of three quarks, would have baryon number 3 times the baryon number of a quark, so it would have baryon number 1. So a proton or a neutron has baryon number 1. And similarly, there's an analogous concept is lepton number, where each lepton has lepton number 1, and then all other particles, quarks, Higgs particles, every other particle that we know of, has no lepton number. So in other words, the only things that have lepton numbers are electrons, neutrinos, and their higher analogs, muons, muon neutrinos, tau particles, tau neutrinos, as far as we know. So we have never seen a process. Every process that we see is like proton plus electron goes to neutron plus neutrino, for example. And you know, so there's the left-hand side here has baryon number of 1 plus 0. The right-hand side has baryon number of 1 plus 0. The left-hand side has lepton number 1, 0 plus 1, and the right-hand side has lepton number 1, 0 plus 1. So in every process we have ever observed, those two quantities are conserved. And yet, at least for baryon number, we know that the universe is asymmetric today, that it has baryons left over but no antibaryons. And so if you look back into the early universe, when the universe was so hot that baryons and antibaryons were both relativistic and in thermal equilibrium, that means that, if you look back before when the temperature was above the mass of the proton, for example, the mass of the proton and the neutron, in other words, the mass of the lightest baryons, then the universe was full of protons and antiprotons and neutrons and antineutrons. And these were all just relativistic particles. They had basically the same number density as the photons. But in fact, the observed fact is that for every billion protons, there were a billion and one. For every billion antiprotons, there were a billion and one protons. For every billion antineutrons, there were a billion and one neutrons. So that when they annihilated, all of the antibaryons, all the antiprotons and antineutrons got completely annihilated, but one in a billion of the protons and neutrons were left over to live to the present. Okay? And so that's why, that is why this thing we call the baryon to photon ratio, roughly speaking, the number density of baryons over the number density of photons, is observed to be, in various ways, of order 1 in a billion. So this is the thing we want to explain. Now, if baryon number was a perfectly conserved quantity, the explanation would be, well, this ratio of baryon density to photon density is the total asymmetry between baryons and antibaryons, the total amount of baryon number in the universe, if it's conserved, then all you can do is just put it in as an initial condition. You say, okay, as the initial conditions for the universe, apparently someone set it up so that for every baryon, for every billion antibaryons, there was a billion and one baryons. So that is not the modern answer to the question. The modern answer to the question is due, the modern picture is due to this guy Sakharov, Andrei Sakharov, who, I don't have time to mention this, but I can't resist. I mean, so this guy, you know, people know this guy? He's a very unusual, unique person. He was sort of central to the, he was also the person who invented the, he was a very brilliant physicist, and he was the person who invented the tokamak, which is sort of the leading candidate to produce controlled fusion. He was one of the central people behind the designing the, he was one of the central people to the Russian hydrogen bomb effort, and then in his later life became an outspoken anti-nuclear critic, and more generally became a sort of dissident, Soviet dissident, and rotted for most of this latter part of his life in prison camps, and then won the Nobel Peace Prize. And he also is credited with being the person who understood. So one of the key parts of modern cosmology is that there is a spectrum, a measurable spectrum of oscillations in the statistics of the cosmic microwave background. That's like our best experimental probe of the early universe. And so that was discovered independently in Russia and the United States in the 1960s, that idea. And so supposedly it was Sakharov who realized that in a dream and then told Seldovich and Sunyaev about it, and those two guys wrote the paper. And so Sakharov is not on the paper, but you'll often hear Russians refer to them as Sakharov oscillations or Sakharov peaks. Anyway, but so another of his contributions is this alternative conception of how baryogenesis took place, which is that the universe started with zero asymmetry between baryons and antibaryons, had exactly the same abundance of baryons and antibaryons. But then as the expansion evolved, the laws of nature preferred baryons over antibaryons. And so gradually in the expansion this asymmetry developed. So in other words, instead of putting it as an initial condition, you put in a perfectly symmetric initial condition and then let the dynamical laws produce baryon number. And so he asked, you know, if this was how it worked, then he realized that three conditions, now called the Sakharov conditions, had to be satisfied. And so the first of those was that, you know, if you're going to go from zero net baryon number to positive net baryon number, apparently baryon number is not conserved. So for this picture to be correct, baryon number had to be violated. So at the time, that seemed like a radical suggestion. Today, we haven't observed this yet, but it now seems. Yeah, so now on theoretical grounds, we think that this more or less has to be true. Secondly, C and CP, so charge conjugation symmetry and the combination of charge conjugation and parity, these two discrete symmetries. Remember, there's sort of three basic discrete symmetries in quantum field theory, C, P, and T. And in a Lorentz invariant local quantum field theory, it essentially has to be the case that CPT is conserved, but other various combinations do not necessarily have to be conserved. And E. So, you know, the basic idea here is that you go from an initial state, the assumption, the idea of the picture is that you go from an initial state where There's an equal number of baryons and antibaryons in a completely homogeneous isotropic universe. So every direction is the same as every other direction. And then you evolve into a state that does not have symmetry between baryons and antibaryons. So it does not, there's more baryons than antibaryons. So you evolve from a C and CP symmetric state to a C and CP antisymmetric state. So that means the dynamical laws that evolve from one state to the other must also violate those symmetries in order to evolve from a state that is symmetric under those symmetries to one that is not symmetric. And then finally, you need violation of thermal equilibrium. So you need the early universe to have gone significantly out of thermal equilibrium at some moment during its initial evolution. So I was just going to give you the sort of classic, a quick. Next time at the beginning of class before starting inflation, I'll just give a quick. Intro to the initial classic picture of a particle physics model, the simplest grand unified theory in which you can see explicitly how these three conditions get satisfied in the model. And so it just sort of brings them home. But generally speaking, we don't know, actually. There are a lot of different... What we do know is that the fact that there is baryon asymmetry in the universe today is some hint about physics beyond the standard model. The standard model alone cannot account for it. It's giving one of these precious clues about what comes beyond the standard model. But there are a lot of models alternative models that do manage to produce the baryon asymmetry. We'll only have time to discuss the sort of canonical one. But hopefully give a flavor of how, you know, given a model, you can estimate whether it might be right or might be wrong. You know, one thing that there is not yet is anything analogous to the Wimp miracle. That is to say, there's no canonical model that has the property that... There are a lot of models that say, okay, if you choose the values of the parameters in the model right, you can get a baryon-antibaryon asymmetry that's equal to the one that we observe. But if you had changed the parameters, you could have gotten another value. It would be nice if someone had a model that said, you know, not only can this produce a baryon-antibaryon asymmetry, but it basically has to produce 10 to the minus 9, which is the value that you observe. But that basically doesn't exist yet. And so, you know, something to shoot for. So try to, you know. I recommend one of you invent that. I guess that's all I was going to say. Sorry.
There won't be any component lecture on Thursday. Instead, Ruth Gregory is going to give two lectures. Instead, on Friday, we're going to have two cosmology lectures, one at 9, the other one at the usual time. And the next tutorial will be on Friday as well. Not everyone today, but the other one.